Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, March 3rd, 2025. I'm Lee Robertus in the news tonight. Withdrawal from WAMI, Medicaid expansion repeal, and taxpayer money going to religious indoctrination. Topics at Coffee Chamber of Commerce. Coffee with the Legislature event put on by the Chamber of Commerce this weekend. Doge firings leave employees of the Spokane VA hospital man grand staff without jobs, and Washington legislator targets library pride flag in Republic. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robertus, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The future of WAMI, the Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho collaboration to train doctors in the five states through the University of Washington School of Medicine, was a major topic at the Coffee with the Legislators Town Hall at the Moscow Chamber of Commerce Saturday morning. Three Republican representatives, including House Speaker Mike Moyle of Starr, introduced House Bill 176 this legislative session, which could end the University of Idaho's association with the WAMI program, in which the UI has been partners since 1972. Under the WAMI program, 40 Idaho students get seats in the state-subsidized medical school each year, with most of the coursework occurring at the University of Washington or at remote locations in the five states. There has been increasing tension between Idaho legislators and the University of Washington in recent years. House Bill 176 proposes WAMI's relationship with the University of Idaho would be phased out, and the UI would then partner with a so far unidentified school, quote, in the Mountain Time Zone, unquote, for physician training. There are implications the move by the three Republicans are political pushback against Washington, which is an abortion freedom state, and therefore does train doctors at the University of Washington in how to perform abortions, both in emergency situations or on demand. 80 people attended the gathering with the two District 6 House members Saturday in Moscow, Republican Lori McCann of Lewiston and Republican Brandon Mitchell of Moscow. Here's audience member Kathy Dawes, who ran as a Democrat against Brandon Mitchell, asking a question about WAMI of McCann and Mitchell.
And I have heard nothing in the discussion as to why, medically, we would want to leave one of the top 10 medical schools in the country. I just think this program is so critically important. And I know there's been other doctors that have testified that they are from another state and they came here to do their residency and wound up staying.
I decided I was going to reach out directly to President Green and talk to him because I needed to know, is the university in favor of this? Where are we? And so, honestly, there's been some challenges with the university and the U of Dub and trying to get an agreement signed to, A, get us more seats in WAMI, and we've asked several times, and they have denied that request. So that's been a challenge. There's a challenge with the legislature passing the WAMI budget because of the legislature's fear of doctors being trained in abortion care. So that has been a fight every year on the floor. And the University of Utah has reached out and said that they could be a really good partner for Idaho. And so that is kind of where they're looking. The university folks are saying to us that they feel that Utah would be a better partner. They are a good medical school. They may not be the U of Dub, but they still are in, they are a good school, and we could be proud of our doctors. We would keep the WAMI in place until the current students would matriculate out. And so, and Brendan, I don't know if you have other things you want to add to that, but So the reason I have decided I would vote for it is because the university, and we represent the university in this district, and so I've been told that they feel much more comfortable with the partnership in the University of Utah.
We said we need more seats because where the seats are is usually where the doctors stay, and that's what we need, is we need more doctors here in Idaho. Well, in that time, they haven't given us more seats, but they decided to take on Gonzaga and add more seats in Washington. They got tons of doctors in Washington, high rate. Over here, we don't. But they're given more seats over in Washington again. And that's one of the problems. So the other thing that Representative McCann brought up was the abortion issue. And so we asked them to sign a contract with us saying that we're not required to teach that in Idaho because of what the legislature's done down in the past. So they refused to sign it. And then 18 months later, House Bill 176 starts. And they go, oh, we're going to sign it. So it took us pushing them to get them to actually finally sign something on there.
That was Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, preceded by Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston. One person asked about assurances that the medical doctor education program stay at the University of Idaho. So far, lawmakers have spoken of two possible schools to strike an agreement with, either the University of Utah or the Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine, a private for-profit medical school next door to Idaho State University's Meridian campus. Here's Representative McCann, followed by Representative Mitchell.
The bill has been sitting on the third reading calendar for quite a while because there have been questions. Representative Mitchell and I are part of those questions because we keep asking to make sure, A, that we have assurances from the University of Utah that those seats are going to, in fact, be able to go to that school. And right now there was nothing really in writing specifically because Utah also has to make some changes, and they're running simultaneously bills through the Utah legislature right now so that they can add the seats and have that availability. So those bills are trying to go through at the same kind of same rate, so to speak, and so to get all of our questions answered. So memorandums of understanding are going to be signed. I've been told I haven't seen them yet, but that is the plan to have those in place. And originally, yes, they wanted the seats to go to ICOM, and we fought vigorously, and Carolyn fought vigorously for the university to maintain our MD program. And the state board's been fairly quiet, and the university really couldn't come out and talk because they were told to kind of keep this quiet through the state board, so to speak, almost like a gag order. But I said, I don't have a gag order, so I'm going to talk about it because it's important that people understand. And at some point, we need to get the full story out to the people because it's I don't think it's been as transparent for you all as it should be. So, but those are what we're working towards, to get those agreements in place so that we understand exactly what the end goal is here, and where we're in the process. It's like the sausage is getting made, but I don't know where the end goal is yet. I mean, I think the end goal is they want to move to University of Utah, and have those seats, 40. Right now they have 10 in University of Utah, and we would like to move the 40 from WAMI into the University of Utah, and they have agreed that we can grow our program, whereas we were not able to grow our program with the University of Washington. And I think that's probably the main issue that we have been fighting. And there's some political things in the middle of it that always causes a few of us to get heartburn over. But we're trying to work through those right now. That's as good an answer as I can give you, unless you've got something that I don't know of. So.
No, and I think that she answered that really, really well, because we are waiting on the university. So House Bill 176 is being held, and I think that's why it's being held, is because we're waiting for all these moving parts to move around. But it is going to add more seats, and our end goal is to get more doctors, as Luis just was talking about. That's our end goal. We want to get more doctors in Idaho, and so we're already working with a lot of the other facilities and stuff. There's only one hospital out in Boise that's really strongly against this. All the other ones are going, okay, we get this. We understand. So the end goal is to get more doctors, and I think that's the direction we're moving into.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well,
thank
one
you.
Last, can
you
I say?
You answered the question of where okay. will the students and the facility be?
Staying right here.
Yeah, staying here for yep. their 2 years like they always have been, I believe.
Under the direction of the University of Utah.
Well, it's going to be the same kind of merger that we have with UW right now, right? Because the with everything that we have with UW and with WAM, or with the whole WAMI program, all it's going to do is just take us out of the WAMI program, put us in with the University of Utah. So we're going to be merged the same way as we are with Washington right now.
That was Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, and you also heard from Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston in that clip.
Idaho legislation that would end the state's participation in a regional medical education program is facing a groundswell of opposition. WAMI, which stands for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho, is a partnership overseen by the University of Washington School of Medicine to train physicians in the region. The program started in 1972 as the goal of increasing medical professionals in largely rural states like Idaho. Dr. Mark Uranga is a pediatrician in Boise and a WAMI grad. He spent time in McCall and Pocatello with the program, noting those cities don't have the infrastructure of a medical school.
By getting people to that experience, the goal is really for them to see the beauty in those relationships that people build, both in a rural setting and in a setting where there's less historical presence of medical educators.
Idaho has a severe shortage of doctors, ranking last in states for its physician-to-population ratio. More than 1,600 Idahoans, including people involved in the program, have signed a letter urging lawmakers not to end WAMI. Supporters of House Bill 176 ending the partnership say the state has had issues with the University of Washington, in part because the school hasn't agreed to the state's request restricting spending on abortion care. Liz Woodruff is head of the Idaho Academy of Family Physicians. She says while there are opportunities to grow medical education, ending the program would be a major blow to the physician pipeline in the state. Since 1972, Idaho has retained 73% of graduates of the program in the state or affiliated states. Woodruff says the surge in support for WAMI in the past week is reaching the Capitol.
We believe that community concern about legislation that would end WAMI has created an opportunity for lawmakers to think more about medical education and how we can grow it in Idaho in effective ways. And we believe that any future for medical education needs to include the WAMI program.
Uranga, who is an educator in the program, says replacing it and recreating it from the ground up would take decades.
The reason that the WAMI community is asking for a pause on this legislation is because basically it would scatter this preceptor group, this clinical education, to the wind, and it wouldn't provide any framework for it to carry forward in any other new capacity.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Republican Representative Jordan Redman of Coeur d'Alene has revised his bill to dramatically change Idaho's Medicaid program. His previous bill would have required the shutting down of Medicaid expansion, which serves about 89,000 Idahoans who make too much to receive regular Medicaid but too little to be eligible for subsidized health insurance through the Affordable Care Act if 11 conditions were not met. Critics said the bill, if passed, would have almost inevitably required the shutdown of expanded Medicaid because one of the requirements would have been the reduction of expanded Medicaid from the nearly 90,000 people it currently serves to 50,000 by early next year. Redman is co-sponsoring his new bill, House Bill 328, with Republican Senator Julie Van Orden of Pingree. The new bill would move the entire Medicaid program in Idaho to a third-party managed care organization that would allocate and oversee benefits. It would end the current system of using value care organizations, which are led by physicians and hospital organizations, to manage benefits. The bill would also end presumptive eligibility for people who arrive at a hospital who are likely eligible for Medicaid. It would also give the Idaho Health and Welfare Department director authority to cut costs if the federal government reduces payment matches on Medicaid expansion. Currently, the federal government pays 90% of expanded Medicaid. The Idaho Press reports healthcare advocates are concerned House Bill 328 will add unnecessary bureaucratic hurdles and limit healthcare access. Full Circle Health CEO Dr. Ted Epperle, who is Healthcare Transformation Council of Idaho co-chair, said he has changed his mind after spending 15 years working to get Idaho to adopt a value-based care model. Epperle told the Idaho Press, "I was in favor of the VCO model, very much so. I wanted it to run its course, and now we're faced with the aftermath of the pandemic, which is high-cost care, especially in the Medicaid population." He said the value-based care organizations were unprepared to deal with the high cost of care that happened when many people put off preventive health care during the height of the pandemic. Dr. Epperle says large managed care organizations would have more experience for, quote, handling the complexities of the post-pandemic environment. I think it's an opportunity to move forward as long as the vision is not just to slash and burn and cut expense, but to redesign for efficiency and support primary care, then I think we can get to a better place.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you. And by
Latah Wildlife Association, encouraging hunters to use lead-free ammunition for the benefit of their families, predators, scavengers, and the environment. Available online at facebook.com/Latah Wildlife Association. For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night, so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
You can listen to the radio.
You've got it right.
Listen, listen, anytime you listen, everybody's on a mission, and there ain't nothing missing when you listen to the radio.
You listen to the radio.
You've got it right.
Community radio.
Listen, and you give a little listen to the radio.
Radio Free Moscow.
Fight Back Radio.
90.3 on your radio dial. Fight back.
Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for your support. So keep on listening and listening and listening.
Fight back.
We're still here.
Radio.
Fight
back.
Frustration about taxpayer money going towards religious schools was evident at the Moscow Chamber of Commerce coffee with the legislators gathering Saturday, attended by about 80 people. Governor Brad Little last week signed House Bill 93, which will make $50 million in tax breaks available to parents for private or religious schools. The two District 6 House members, Republican Lori McCann of Lewiston and Republican Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, were in attendance. There was also discussion of a religious indoctrination bill going through the legislature that would require every public school in the state to conduct daily Bible passage readings in occupied classrooms every morning for 10 years of a student's voyage through grade school. The Idaho Family Policy Center drafted the bill, sponsored by Republican Representative Jordan Redman of Coeur d'Alene. Here's an audience member asking Representatives McCann and Mitchell about bills imposing religion.
My time in Idaho, I've always been really appreciative of the fact that there was respect for individuals. And I have some concerns. I feel like the line between church and state is eroding. Yeah. I'm a lifetime Episcopalian and very involved in my faith, and it's really important to me, but I've never used it against other people, and I'm feeling a little uncomfortable about individual rights, and I'd love for both of you to tell us where you feel the line is drawn.
Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell said he doesn't think that bill is going anywhere because it's been bottled up on the third reading. Here's Mitchell, followed by Lori McCann.
Well, to answer the question, the way that I look at it is I'm here to protect every religion. I don't think that the state should ever infringe on any religion. I truly do believe that. And when we're talking about the separation of church and state, going back in history and recognizing what that truly is, separation of church and state is that the state cannot tell you you have to follow a certain religion. That's what it is. It's not the opposite way around, and a lot of people are using it the opposite way around, saying you can't have any church in or any religion in state. Every morning when we go in, we say a prayer. We say the Pledge of Allegiance. Every morning we do that at the Capitol, on both the House side and the Senate side. So there's we use that all the time. Huh?
You don't have to say it. You don't have to pledge it.
Sorry.
Which is what he's saying.
Apologize, Representative.
My point is that our founding fathers, all of this was, they fled persecution because of that. And they want, there's nothing saying that when we're talking the separation, like I said, the separation is that the church, the state can't tell you what religion to follow. That's the biggest key to remember. And a lot of times we forget about that side of things. So when it comes to like prayer and schools and whatnot, I don't have a problem with it if they're not forcing them to follow a certain religion. So that's kind of how I look at it.
So the separation of church and state, the argument that we're hearing, it's nowhere in the Constitution, and it may not specifically say it in the Constitution, but I believe strongly that we have three branches of government, and in the judicial branch of the government, there have been many decisions that have come down over the years that have tried to redefine what that all means. And I was raised very religious in a very conservative Lutheran home. I still practice my religion. I still have I'm very spiritual, and but I do not agree that we should have reading the Bible in the schools. I'm very against that, and I told the person who brought that I said, and the reason, not that I'm not a Christian and not that I don't believe, because I do, but I know there are other families that have a different belief. I said, what about my Jewish friends? What about my non-Christian friends? What about people who just have a totally different belief? And if we're going to read out of one specific Bible every verse for 10 years without any comment, without any discussion, I said, I believe it's wrong, and I think that bill will die. I don't think it's going to.
The issue of the state sanctioning religion spilled over into the issue of taxpayer money paying for religious indoctrination. Governor Brad Little signed House Bill 93 last week, which is the $50 million private school funding bill. Opponents say it will begin the process of defunding public schools in the state. In his State of the State address in January, Governor Little said he would support a $50 million private school funding bill if it's, quote, fair, responsible, transparent, and accountable, and does not harm public schools. However, the bill the legislature passed specifically prohibits transparency and accountability. It says, quote, the provisions of this section shall not be construed to permit any government agency to exercise control or supervision over any education of non-public school students. A non-public school shall not be required to alter its creed, practices, admissions policy, or curriculum in order to accept students whose payment of tuition or fees stems from a refundable tax credit under this section. This member of the audience was getting at that, and Representatives McCann and Mitchell implied none of the so-called school choice bills would have gone through if they regulated public schools.
First Amendment actually prevents the government from establishing religion and the free practice thereof. So it does say in the Constitution that we shouldn't be forced, religion shouldn't be put on people. So about House Bill 93, the red herring of choice is weak. There's always been parents' right to choose where to send your kids, assuming there are schools available in your area. Parents have always been able to choose. Now that private schools are going to start receiving public dollars, what's the legislature, what's the state planning on doing to ensure that schools are regulated or legislated or controlled as our public schools? When you guys pass a law that says there's no more flags allowed in public schools, does that going to now fall into the Christian schools who have their own sets of flags? What do you plan on doing about that? How are you guys planning on legislating and regulating private schools?
we are not in that. In 93, there is no regulation and no regulating at all of any private schools in that. And so, and I think that was by design. But many of us felt that if it's going to be public dollars that are going to private school, that the people have the right to know and have to more transparency on where those dollars are spent. And that was one hiccup for me, that there is nothing in there that really helps to determine true transparency on the dollars and how they flow. When we say money follows a student, it sounds great, but the average Idahoans pay $1,200 a year in state taxes. Average Idahoans. Let's just for a minute start calculating, and when they do their tax return and say, well, I've gone to a private school, and here are my vouchers or here are my payments, but it gets down to their tax credit and they only pay $1,200, so they are going to get back substantially more than they ever paid in. And so to me, I was saying, how is that truly money following the student if that's what you paid? But I get the other side of the argument, and that if there's $8,000 per child being spent in the district, parents are saying, then I want to take my $8,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is to a private school. It was probably at least, I can't even tell you how many, but just a handful of please yes, and huge numbers of I don't want my tax dollars going to fund public private schools. There would be huge fights over if we were going to try to regulate private school.
First, we need to look back in history. House Bill 24, which was the launch program. We were already taking taxpayer dollars and sending it to private religious schools. BYU-Idaho, NNU, they're all getting it, right?
Shouldn't have been.
Okay. So we've already broken that barrier, right? As far as what kind of protections there, I couldn't tell you. Just like Representative McCann, who knows what gets brought up down the road? We don't know. House Bill 93 came out. Yeah, I thought it was a good bill. It wasn't the greatest. We had a Senate bill that we knew wasn't going anywhere. Right? Because it had all kinds of different protections in it and whatnot. And so that one we knew wasn't going anywhere. We did, however, know that this year, Governor Little's State of the State, we were going to set aside $50 million to use for school choice. So we knew that was coming ahead of time before anything even started. Day one, he told us that was going to come. As far as what kind of protections or what kind of guardrails they'll put, I don't know. That's for a legislature down the road or something that we may try and bring up next year. Who knows?
That was Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, preceded by Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston at a Moscow Chamber of Commerce Coffee with the Legislators program Saturday morning. Lori McCann of Lewiston voted against House Bill 93, and Brandon Mitchell of Moscow voted in favor. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. In a related story, 86% of the messages the public produced for Idaho Governor Brad Little's office in the week before he signed House Bill 93, the Taxpayer Money for Private and Religious Schools Bill, were opposed to the bill. Little's staff tallied 37,457 phone calls and emails, and 32,000 expressed opposition to the bill. Little's press secretary, Joan Varsek, said Governor Little considers a variety of factors in weighing his decision on any bill that reaches his desk. The Idaho Press reports Varsek did not respond to a request for specific factors the governor considered when making the decision on House Bill 93. The automated phone system at Governor Little's office asked callers to push 1 for sign and 2 for veto. The recording said the governor was only accepting feedback from Idaho residents and only 1 call per person. Varsek said staff did not tally repeated phone calls from the same number. Last week, after Governor Little signed the bill, Idaho Education Association President Lane McAnally said House Bill 93 is just the beginning. Voucher proponents, eager to help out-of-state billionaires plunder Idaho's public school budget are already planning how to exploit and expand this program during 2026's legislative session. Each year, they will try to siphon more and more tax dollars away from public schools as a gift to private and religious schools and their patrons. Idaho 50501 is planning a demonstration at the state capitol tomorrow at noon Mountain Time to take a stand against the growing Trump dictatorship in Washington, D.C. A statement from Idaho 50501 says more than 20 volunteers founded the movement on Reddit in Idaho to join the national call against authoritarianism and has already held two large rallies at the state house in Boise. The statement continues, "The movement's next major action will take place on March 4th at noon when Idahoans will once again gather at the state capitol to stand against the growing dictatorship in Washington, D.C. This protest will send a clear message. The people will not be silenced. We are everyday people who saw the warning signs and knew we had to act. The stakes are too high to sit on the sidelines. This administration has made it clear that it will trample rights, reject facts, and silence opposition. Position, we refuse to let that happen." The Trump Veterans Administration laid off 12 workers at Spokane's Mann Grand Staff Veterans Administration Medical Center last week, a few weeks after 18 workers at the hospital agreed to take a buyout from the federal government. The 12 new dismissals were probationary employees. In federal government parlance, a probationary employee has been in their current position for less than 1 or 2 years, depending on the position. Long-time and career federal employees are probationary for a certain time after a promotion. The spokesman review reports on Tuesday, the day after the layoffs notices came, managers received another email asking them to rank the 12 laid off employees according to need and to give written notification of reasons the VA might rehire any of them. A Mann Grand Staff official told the spokesman in review, under condition of anonymity, they were told that they were fired for their performance, which was not true in the eyes of their supervisors or their coworkers. Veterans Administration Northwest Region Chief Human Resources Officer Andrea Smith announced the firings in the email Monday. Smith said 84 employees would be laid off in the region, 12 in Spokane, 6 in Walla Walla, 13 in Boise, and 14 in the Puget Sound area. An administrator told the paper those employees who received termination emails were quickly locked out of their computer accounts. A number of those employees raced to print out their employment records before their computers were completely locked out. Republican Washington State Senator Shelley Short of Addy has pulled her support for a state appropriation for a new library building in Republic because the library board in the small town has refused to remove a pride flag hanging over a window in the library's current building. The spokesman review reports North Central Washington Libraries district officials say there are pride flags at other libraries across the region, but they are only controversial in Republic. A local ad hoc group called Republic Library Changemakers wants to limit flag displays at the library to only the U.S. and Washington state flag. Library Changemakers have said at previous meetings the pride flag makes them feel uncomfortable and unsafe. Representative Short wrote in a statement, "With great reluctance, I have decided not to pursue a capital budget appropriation for the Republic Library for the 2025 legislative session. I have long been a supporter of strong libraries in our communities. However, a local controversy regarding the year-round display of a gay pride flag has proven extremely divisive, and until it is resolved, action on our part in Olympia to expand this facility would only deepen local frustration with library management."
Several bills working their way through Olympia focus on reforming Washington's juvenile legal system, including one known as the Youth Hope Act. The act would give eligible young offenders transitioning from juvenile detention to adult correctional facilities a chance to petition a board for early release. Diego Gonzalez attends Seattle University and is on the Youth Advisory Board for Team Child, a nonprofit organization backing the act. He says youth offenders deserve a second chance.
That's basically what this bill is just trying to do. It's trying to let somebody grow and live past the worst thing they've done as a youth.
Critics of the act are concerned about the risks of releasing offenders too soon. Research shows youth incarceration most often increases reoffending rates while impeding young people's educational and career success. The Youth Hope Act is currently in the Senate Ways and Means Committee. For serious crimes, children under 18 in Washington may be tried as adults and face 20 to 30 years in custody. Arthur Longworth is a policy manager at Team Child. He says Washington's determinate juvenile sentencing system does not leave room for youth to be rehabilitated.
Judges are basically handcuffed. They have to follow a guideline matrix for what a young person is sentenced to without considering circumstances too much.
Gonzalez got involved with Team Child after his friend Sunshine Timmons was sentenced to 20 years for a crime she committed at 17. Timmons is now in the custody of the Department of Corrections. Gonzalez believes she grew in juvenile rehabilitation and, given a chance, could be doing good work in her community.
But instead, they were forced to go to DOC, and it's a bad place. That does not help the people there.
About 50,000 youth are in confinement in the United States. That number is 60% lower than 25 years ago, thanks in part to growing awareness of the negative impacts of incarceration on young people. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Legislative bills on housing have seen mixed results in Montana so far this session. A state nonprofit group held an online training on how to provide public comment about those bills, aimed at young people for whom affordable housing is a major challenge. Montana's population grew by over 36,000 people between 2020 and early 2024, creating massive housing shortages and skyrocketing prices. Sage Bennett with the advocacy group Forward Montana says providing written comments on bills or verbal comments during hearings can help expand others' worldviews.
You don't have to be a policy expert to share testimony. That's what our elected officials are there to understand, and we are there to provide comment to be able to have them understand the real-world impacts that these policies have on us.
Housing-related bills working their way through the legislature include one to amend zoning laws to allow taller buildings and another to establish a grant program to create permanent supportive housing for people dealing with homelessness. A bill to provide some renters the first right to buy a property if their landlord intends to sell was tabled last week. Those who want to comment online must create an account and register for a bill hearing at least 2 hours in advance. Forward Montana State Legislative Coordinator John Bazant says commenters should come prepared but be flexible as time allotments for comments may change.
This 1 minute warning beep can be pretty jarring and it will probably interrupt you. And then because it can depend on how long they give you for your testimony, having a long version and a short version is a ton of help.
According to the Montana Budget and Policy Center, workers paid the state's $10.55 minimum wage would have to work 80 to 90 hours per week to afford fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Flathead, Gallatin, Missoula, and three other counties. I'm Kathleen Shannon with Big Sky Connection.
The Department of Government Efficiency, led by billionaire Elon Musk, has ordered the federal government to fire 400 Department of Fish and Wildlife employees. Experts say the move could tremendously impact Oregon's endangered and threatened species. Noah Greenwald is with the Center for Biological Diversity. He says the cuts mean population surveys of the Northwest's iconic northern spotted owl have been paused, along with plans to remove invasive barred owls from their habitat. Greenwald says these measures are critical to the owl's survival.
These people are being let go have nothing to do with waste and fraud. These are people who are doing real work to conserve our endangered species and wildlife.
A federal judge found that the firings are likely illegal, but it is unclear if employees will be rehired or if future firings will stop. The Center for Biological Diversity filed a Freedom of Information request with every region of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to get more information about the impact of the changes. Greenwald says that, along with harm to wildlife, cuts to staff could mean a lack of services for people visiting Oregon's wild places this spring and summer.
We could have overflowing toilets. We could have traffic problems that are unabated. There could be rescues that are needed. That won't happen.
Proponents of the cuts say the employees were primarily probationary, meaning they were recently hired or promoted, so losing their positions will not mean a loss of essential services. Greenwald says new people often get the most done, including writing recovery plans for threatened species. He warns that as many as 1 million species are at risk of extinction in the coming decades.
These federal workers are at the front line of fighting that extinction crisis and ensuring that we have a livable future.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The Moscow City Council will hear its annual comprehensive report from the Finance and Employee Services Director, Sarah Decker, tonight, as well as Nick Nicholson of Presnell Gage, which is the city's contracted auditing firm. The council will also hear the annual report on the city-owned 1912 Center building from Jenny Kostrov of Heart of the Arts Incorporated. The nonprofit Heart of the Arts manages the 1912 Center under a contract with the city. The Moscow City Council will meet at 7 p.m. tonight at City Hall. Well, that's it for the KRFP evening report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area, there is a 20% chance of precipitation tonight, 20% chance of rain before 10 p.m., snow level 4,800 feet, lowering to 4,000 feet after midnight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 34, west winds 5, becoming calm in the evening, gusts up to 20, 30% chance of rain tomorrow, mainly after 4 p.m., snow level 3,600 feet, rising to 4,300 feet in the afternoon, mostly cloudy, high 47. Tuesday night, 40% chance of precipitation, chance of rain before midnight, then a slight chance of rain and snow, snow level 4,100 feet, lowering to 3,100 feet after midnight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 32, little or no snow accumulation expected, and mostly clear Wednesday through Friday, with highs each day 48 and lows each night 29. Current temperature 40 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. Coming up, Flashpoints, Greg Palast returns with the Election Crimes Bulletin, coming right up on KRFP.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change. KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including justice and multiculturalism.